we can learn from the past, and it's a good thing to have this open conversation about how we feel and how it felt to be told those things. And if it had been said slightly differently, would I still be thinking about this today? It's still in my head. Your body is not right for ballet.
Hello and welcome back to Red Lips and High Kicks with me, Lydia Holt. Thank you for tuning in for episode 2 of season 2. It's great to be back. I really enjoyed releasing that first episode. I'm so glad to be back in your ears, like I said, and the response was amazing, and it gets me more excited, gets my gears going to get more content out for you guys. So I hope you enjoy this next coming episode. Again, I'm not going to waffle on too much because the episode really do speak for themselves, and I hate cutting down these episodes when I'm talking to my guests because they have so much to say. So I'm going to have to get rid of my bit at the beginning. So I'll be as brief as I can, but just to give you a little bit of a heads up, today I'm talking to Leanne Cope. Leanne, you probably know as the star of An American in Paris. She was the original Lise, which debuted in Broadway. It was the most awarded musical that year at the Tonys and has done exceedingly well in the West End too. Leanne wasn't just a star of the West End. Before that, she was with the Royal Ballet for 12 years. She went all the way through the school and was a complete success in her own right before this amazing thing happened to her. She's got so much knowledge and so much insight into kind of that transition from opera house to musical West End. It's fascinating, and very few people get to do it. So I was really excited to pick her brain about all the things that happened there and the similarities and the differences. And she was so kind, she was so generous, and I really think you guys are going to enjoy this episode because I sure did. You know what I'm going to say now, it's my weekly plug. Please subscribe and give us a comment or a rating. That really means a lot to us on any of your podcasting devices, Apple, Spotify, however you're listening to us. And you can find us on Instagram at redlips.highkicks. Give us a follow and some love there, that'd be great. Thank you so much again for tuning in. I'll be back next week. Have a great day.
Hello, Leanne. It's lovely to have you on my podcast. I'm so excited to be chatting with you today. You've got, one of the broadest breadths of experience and knowledge and all this exciting stuff. So it's going to be great to pick your mind on all of it. Before we get started, I would just like to ask you, you know, it's been such a tough year for everyone, but what has been the biggest lesson you've learned this year?
It's strange because on New Year's Eve, I'd just done a double show of An American in Paris, in Paris. So I stood on a balcony in Paris with a glass of champagne, looking at the sparkling Eiffel Tower, thinking, the roaring 20s, it's going to be amazing. And then obviously wasn't quite the start to the next decade that we'd all hoped for. I think I've been thinking about this question a lot, actually. And I think the only certainty in life is that to expect uncertainty. we don't know what's going to happen. And to be, I think I've learned to be, I like to plan. I like to have things written down. I like to do this at this time. If I'm late, I panic. I like everything to the book. And it's taught me to just throw all that away and just take it all as it comes and deal with it at the time, because most of the time it's going to be all right, even if you're 2 minutes late or if you know, things didn't quite go to plan as you thought it was going to be. So I think it's, for me, the biggest lesson I've learned is to let go a little bit. I'm just going to Elsa Frozen it all the way, just let it go. that's my moral of this year, let it go.
I think that's wise words to live by, for sure.
It's too late for Frozen, but that I'm just gonna, if anything goes wrong, pretend to be Elsa and it will be fine.
she knew what was coming. She was telling us all those years ago, and no one listened, and we should have. So I want to start from the back first, if that's okay. An American in Paris, I mean, it was the epitome of grace and elegance, and it was just such a moment, I think, to see, you know, to see ballet on Broadway and on the West End. How was that experience? How did it come about? Tell us everything.
Oh my goodness, there's so much to tell. Yeah. So it really did come, I wasn't necessarily seeking to leave the Royal Ballet as such. I just, this opportunity just arose. Christopher Wheeldon was in London at the time making Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, the ballet that he made there. And he actually sent me a Facebook message saying, oh, I heard you used to sing in the choir at school. And I was like, yeah, where's this going? And he said, I'd love to hear you sing. I was like, okay, what would you like me to sing? And he said, The Man I Love, which ended up being the song that I sang in the show. So I didn't really know what it was that I was necessarily, I didn't even know it was an audition. I wasn't quite sure what was going on. I thought maybe he needed someone to sing in the ballet or something. I really didn't have a clue. Went home and learnt the song. And then Christopher Wilden's probably one of the busiest men on the planet, zipping from here, there and everywhere. And he's contacted me and is like, I have to go back to New York tomorrow. I have to hear you sing. And we were in a long run of Swan Lake at the time, double show, Saturday. He's like, between the shows, come to my dressing room, you're gonna have to sing. Wow. So, okay. So done one Swan Lake, still headdress on, everything, went to his dressing room. He's like, the best acoustics are in the shower. I stood in the shower, fully clothed, and I sang The Man I Love, and he filmed me on his iPhone, and that was my first audition for American in Paris.
I mean, mad. Of all the other stories of how lead characters got their first audition, how that experience was, yours was just as a swan in a shower. I mean, that's got to be one of its own.
Yeah, so then it just kind of, I still didn't really know what it was for, and I got this email a couple of weeks later from a casting agency in New York, and it was headed Christopher Wilden's An American in Paris, and I was like, oh, okay, so that must have been what it was for, and basically it was setting up every time he came back to London, we would meet secretly, normally on a Sunday morning at the Opera House. We'd sneak in via one of the, not the stage door, around the back so nobody would see us, because obviously it was still a big secret, the show, and nobody at the Opera House knew I was auditioning. The director certainly didn't. And we would sneak in on a Sunday morning and do some work sessions. And finally, I flew to New York and did the audition there, and I got the part.
I mean, amazing. So fairy tale. I love it. It's got so much like sparkle in the excitement to it. Is really, really great. And I mean, did you ever see it coming? I'm like, you said you knew you could sing, but something like that, such like a massive career move for you, was there anything that you thought like was on the horizon?
It's strange because I, at the moment, I'm teaching at Lane Theatre Arts, which is the college that I really, really wanted to go to if I hadn't have gone to upper school.
Yeah.
So at my end of the time, at the end of White Lodge, the director at the time said I wasn't really the best fit for ballet. My body isn't best suited to ballet, really. I've got a short Achilles tendon, short hamstring, all sorts of things going on. And I was in a really, really talented year, like Lauren Cuthbertson.
Oh, wow.
Like, I had these like crazy talented people in my ear. And I think she was kind of thinking she was doing me a favor, like letting me go. So I auditioned for Lanes and got a place, but then ended up somehow getting into upper school. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do ballet, I need to do it now. Yeah. Because ballet won't wait. It's not really some people have managed to come back to it, but I thought, if I'm going to do ballet, I have to do it now. And hopefully, fingers crossed, one day I can be in a musical. And it happened. I just feel like I am really, really lucky. I was very much in the right place at the right time. I happened to be the right age they were looking for. Chris happened to be working in London at that time. I do really think it's just kind of a destiny thing that I was just really, really lucky.
I mean, it's so amazing. It's actually, it happens, I think, a lot more often than we really appreciate, is that the fate and the power of attraction. And actually, you know, you lay all these plans down, but actually what will happen to you will happen to you, and you actually don't have that much control. And obviously, like, you know, you had an amazing, I think that's what's so interesting about this. I remember when you were casting it, seeing, you know, your face everywhere, and I was looking back at some of them quite recently before this interview, and I just love all the narrative is like, this girl was picked out of nowhere, like she was just plucked out of nowhere. It's like, she was in the Royal Ballet, like you had an amazing accomplishment and success before any of this. And it's just so funny, this like rags to riches story they want to tell. But it's like, no, you had done it. You could have retired and that could have been it. And you could have lived the rest of your life on that success. So it's really funny how that sometimes isn't really appreciated.
Yeah, people do like to spin it that way. And it was kind of nice to be like, also, I think maybe because I was in the Royal Ballet, but I was called a ballet. So I wasn't really recognised as a dancer as such here. It would be different if it had been Darcy or Alina Couture or someone that people recognise and that the picture is in the paper. But I was very much, an unknown. Mm. Whereas the difference is with Robbie Fairchild, who was the male lead. Yeah. He was a principal dancer with New York City Ballet, so he very much was known. Yeah. So in some ways, I understand why they did write that. I never felt it kind of diminished what I'd done before, but I understand why, looking back at it, saying I came from nowhere, that it's not quite true.
Yes,
because
you
know, I've done 12 years with the Royal Ballet, you know, that's, like you say, I could quite happily have retired then and been like, wow, I've done 12 years with the Royal Ballet.
And going back to actually what you said about that early kind of cold feet about ballet and actually just not knowing whether it was for you or not, and actually kind of quite a harsh, not rejection as such, but discouragement from your director. How did that feel? Again, you probably would have like 15, 16 at such a sensitive age. How did you, you know, recover from that and regain your confidence in ballet, but also know that you were making the right choice?
I don't, it's strange because I feel like I'm a really slow learner. I remember my mum telling me recently that on one of the, you know, as a kid, you don't know what the teachers are really saying because they talk to your parents about it when you're at White Lodge anyway. And one of the teachers said to my parents, you know, Leanne will get there. It's just going to take her a bit more time. She just takes a bit more time to process things. And I think even at my time at White Lodge, it hadn't really occurred to me. I was just having a lovely time. It didn't occur to me that this could be my job.
Yeah.
Until really that upper school audition came around and I was like, oh, so this is to lead on to hopefully making my living as a dancer. Mm. It's weird. I don't think I did feel like it was rejection because I was always, and it's strange also because I never felt like before I went to White Lodge, yes, I did jazz, I did tap. Yeah. I didn't sing before White Lodge. The only reason I sang was because it was very much encouraged to do one extracurricular thing at White Lodge, whether that was piano, violin, flute, whatever. And I tried piano in my first year and was so bad and hated it that I was like, what's the easiest thing I can do where I won't have to practice? Singing.
Yeah,
so
smart.
I had singing lessons. And then I ended up really, really enjoying it. Yeah. And ended up, they had a music competition at the school and I won the music competition. And it just, it became something I really enjoyed. And I'd always loved musical theatre. Yeah. Like, I think I, as a kid, I would have always chose to see a musical over a ballet.
Yeah. Which I think is actually more common than we give credit for. I think, you know, especially when you're young, like ballet, there's no lyrics. There's not something you can sing along to. As a musical theatre, do really have that like wow factor about them that can hook a lot of children really young.
Yeah. So yeah, the rejection thing, I mean, probably if you ask my mum, I probably did call home in tears, like, and it was more that like the thought of not being with all my friends that I just spent 5 years with. But I think I took it on the chin and was just like, okay, right, well, let's see what else is out there. And auditioned for, like I say, for Lanes, for London Studio Centre, for Performers College, and just put myself out there. And then carried on working hard at White Lodge and ended up going to upper school anyway. And I think that kind of rejection, I don't want to call it rejection, I don't know.
Like an adversity. It's like almost there, but you did have to prove people, you know, you had to prove something.
And I think it almost gave me the feeling of no criticism of the Royal Ballet School, but it was all very much in my time a push towards the two Royal Ballet companies.
Yes, yeah.
And we never really got to look outside. Mm. It's different now because I was before the age of YouTube and Instagram. And, you know, I couldn't see a dancer from New York City Ballet, from the Paris Opera, from anywhere in the world. It just, unless you opened a book in the library, it wasn't available to me. So we didn't know any different. Yeah. But I think it very much gave me the view that there is more out there from that young age. And then I was just, again, very lucky with my time through upper school. I am a grafter. I work really hard. And that's not me like patting myself on the back or anything.
No, but yeah.
I didn't have the natural gifts. I knew I had to. And I also made myself be good at picking up choreography. And that's how I got my job in the company, really, because once they needed students to cover, I was very good at not only learning one spot, but on the other side, in reverse, on the other leg.
Yeah.
And I just became one of those students that they'd be like, oh, just put Leanne on, she'll be fine, she'll get it right. I might not necessarily do it the best, but I'll get it right and stay in line. I was really good at staying in line as well. You know, that's why I got my job, and I never ever stepped into the Royal Ballet thinking I'd ever get any further than the Corps de Ballet. I was so grateful to be there, and that anything more than the Corps de Ballet was such a gift.
I mean, it's amazing, and it's so funny as well that it was the Royal Ballet that gave you that singing lesson, like, as if, you know, they shot themselves in the foot, they lost you because they taught you how to sing. It's so funny, but it is, and it's, I think you're right, and I think, you know, I graduated a few years ago, but it does still exist, this sort of like tunnel vision. You're right, you know, in social media, Instagram stuff, that is a great gift that you actually have options at your fingertips. But there is a tunnel vision, and you really, like, you just want to focus on getting out alive, you know, getting out and making your teachers happy. And you do that.
And being employable.
Exactly, being employable. And I don't know, and I'm kind of split about it, and interesting to know how you feel, is that I have a tunnel vision, and it kind of took me a while after I graduated to kind of come back round and pick up on the skills I'd been ignoring, which is the reason I have the job I have today. So I thought, maybe, you know, was my tunnel vision too tight? Like, should I have kept myself open? But then, you know, what you said at the beginning about ballet is that it is at the beginning of everything. It doesn't wait around. You have to do it kind of first. Actually, if I hadn't had that tunnel vision, would I have had the ability to do other things? You know, it is that, it's a balance of like, was I too focused, or actually being so focused pushed me hard enough that actually I can do both? I don't know, it's a tricky one.
Yeah, well, it's strange because thinking now, if I'd gone to Lane's at 16, I don't think I would have got Lee's
in an American time. That's so interesting.
I would not have been strong enough. Yes, I would have done a musical, hopefully would have done a musical, but I wouldn't have got that role. Because my ballet wouldn't have been strong enough to play Lee's. So I do think I'm all for dancers being multi-talented, as in they, you know, you could be asked to do anything. Like, whoever thought in Chris's Alice in Wonderland there'd be tap dancing? You know, can you spin a plate? Yes, I can. Can you sing? Yes. Can you do this? Yes. And you just say yes, and then you go home and learn it. So that discipline of ballet is going to serve you whatever route you go down.
Yeah. And that actually leads me really nicely into the next question, because I was going to say, you know, you've known the Royal Ballet, you've known ballet for so long, you know, you're a professional. Like I said, those skills you learn about staying in line, like, those are so niche and so specific, but also like worth a lot. Like, that doesn't just happen overnight. So you're in this bubble, and now you're taken completely out of it, and you're working in West End. Like, how was that transition? I mean, you must have felt a bevy of things, but how did you kind of stay afloat, keep going?
The first thing really was moving to New York and being like, oh my God, I'm in New York. And my husband and I have been together since we were 16. So I've never done anything. And we've both been through the Royal Ballet School, both been in the Royal Ballet. We've done everything together, and to suddenly do something not with him was quite scary. To just move to New York and be thrown into this world that I knew very little about. Obviously, you know, I'd done many, many hundreds, maybe thousands of performances in the ballet, but to suddenly be in a musical and be on Broadway and leading the musical. You know, I'd never really, I'd done a handful of principal roles, but in one act ballets.
Yeah.
But to suddenly have the whole show on your shoulders as well. So not only the transition into musical theatre, but the transition to being the principal.
Yeah.
Was really hard and something I couldn't look at the big picture. I had to look at it almost an hour at a time.
Yeah.
Get through this hour. What have I achieved? Okay, I need to work on this for the next hour. This, if I like looked at the fact that one, by the time of opening night, you know, we were going to be on a billboard in Times Square, I think I would have freaked myself out and got the first plane home. So I had to just go literally rehearsal at a time.
Yeah.
And stepping into a room, knowing you know less about this than anybody else in the whole room, is very scary. But and I cried a lot. I cried every day. And I was exhausted, but I was just like, just keep going, it's gonna be fine, it will all work out. Mm. And it's that grit and determination we have as ballet dancers. Mm. And also a kind of weird, sadistic self, I had to prove to myself. Yeah. It wasn't even proving to anyone else, it was to prove to myself. Mm. That I'd given up my job in the Royal Ballet, that people would die to have my job, and I'd given that up. So I had to make this work. I had no choice but to make this work and be the best I possibly could. If the show closed after a month, hopefully it wouldn't be my fault. If I was, it can't just close because one person's really bad. That's out of my control. But if I can step on that stage and know I have given it everything I possibly can, I can walk away with my head held high.
Yeah, amazing. And I appreciate it honestly so much because, yeah, it's so refreshing to hear that even with your stature and how much you achieved, that it was terrifying and you did cry and you had like all those emotions. Because it is, I can only imagine. Like, it must have been so intimidating.
When we came back to London, like you say, for the West End, it was another new group of people. Yeah. And then there was the pressure of it being home.
Yeah.
And having to prove myself in London, and I hadn't danced in London for 2 or 3 years because of leaving to go over to America, and the pressure of it suddenly, the Opera House really is only a 10-minute walk from the Dominion.
Yeah.
And to suddenly prove to London that I was worthy of this part was scary as well.
Yeah, and like it, exactly the doing it on home turf, like I said, you kind of did this bold step, and I mean, I'm massively courageous, an entire different continent, everything else, like you said, you've been with your partner and things you've known, and you know, luckily to stay in the UK, to have put yourself a million miles away from home in one of the like biggest cities in the world must have been terrifying. And so you want that to like pay off and come home and be like, yes, but actually it feels so close to home, so it must have been almost not worse maybe, but like more to prove.
Amazing.
And when you were in those environments and like the choreography started to come and you kind of, you know, finding your feet hour at a time, what were the things that you found that the main differences between that and what you've done as a ballet dancer? Like what prepared you and kind of what you were quite surprised about the whole process?
Yeah, they are two quite different worlds, but I think in some ways that what softened the blow was the fact that Christopher Wheeldon was the director, so he also was very new to this because he'd choreographed a Broadway show before, but he'd never directed a Broadway show.
Yeah.
So he ran it like he would run a ballet studio.
So true.
In that way, I recognised the atmosphere, whereas that was quite new to all the musical theatre performers.
I see.
Like, we had to do ballet class every morning, and they were like, what? Ballet class at 9 o'clock in the morning before rehearsal, where Chris wanted everyone to do class in the morning. So in some ways that was quite comforting.
Yeah.
Because I recognised that. But it was different in that there is very much a discussion between the front of the room and the artists. Mm. Whereas, you know, in a ballet company, it very much is you're told to do something and you do it and you don't ask questions. And I used to, even if I had a break, I would sit in and watch rehearsals because I want to see how it was properly done rather than me thinking my way through it. And, you know, they could spend half an hour discussing one sentence in in the script. And I'd be like, oh, just do it. Like in ballet, just do it. And now I understand why, as an actor, their process, they have to understand every incentive behind every line to find the truth behind it. You know, there was one, Vianne Cox, I'll never forget it. She's like, but what color's the carpet? And I was like, does it matter? Like, and for her, it really did matter what this carpet felt like that she was walking on. Wow. What the wallpaper would be. She just needed to know everything. And for it, just that, we don't have time in ballet.
No.
To think about that. But actors, that's their process. Mm. And it was really interesting to see that. And I don't think I plucked up the courage during the Broadway rehearsals to ever be like, can I ask? I just did. But once we got to West End, I thought, no, I'm going to take on what I learned. And all those little questions that I still had in the back of my mind, thinking, you've already done this show. Oh my goodness, I'm sorry, they're drilling next door.
Don't worry, it's fine.
Those questions that I wish I'd asked and still haven't quite figured out in my head, I finally plucked up the courage to ask them.
Yeah.
And so glad I did, because it made it made her even clearer to me.
And that's so interesting, and you're right, it must be just a ballet thing that we get taught at school, is like, you know, the less questions you ask the better. If you can get it by whatever demonstration, like whatever the director said, you can translate it to yourself, like the less the better. And it's so interesting how different that must be.
You don't want to feel like you're a time waster as such.
Of course.
You just, like, almost the least amount of information they can give you and you can still pick it up is the best.
Yes, yeah.
But for an actor, they just want more. Give me as much information as you possibly can, and then I'll carve out this character that you want me to find. It's just, that was the biggest learning curve.
Yeah, and was there anything that you, like, missed a bit from the ballet world? I mean, you said a bit of the, you know, slower, and it was all this kind of diving in and research of everything. But was there anything that you kind of clung to from your ballet days that you sort of wish was a bit more of, was more in your new environment?
I guess further down the line, the variety.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a bit of a creature of habit, so I quite like doing the same thing again.
Yeah.
I know for a lot of people, doing 8 shows a week of the same thing, week after week after week, would be their worst nightmare. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the biggest hurdle that ballet dancers would come across.
Yes.
Being in a musical. And I think, again, that's quite different to, say, being in, like, Matthew Bourne's company, because they swap roles within.
Yeah.
But in a musical, your role is your role.
Yeah.
And you're not going to swap into someone else's. So I guess further down the line, once we've been going a little bit, I did crave a bit of variety dance-wise.
Yeah, and I think it's also a good point about, like I said there, that 8 shows a week, that, you know, ballet is incredibly hard as it is, but you've trained yourself to kind of have those peaks several times a week. But to have 8 a week, physically and mentally, how did you cope with that?
Yeah, I had to learn very, very quickly, because, like you say, you peak however many times a week you have that show. You can't peak on a Monday, because you will have nothing left by Friday. Mm. And, you know, American Paris was a hard show, and the big ballet came right at the end. Wow. And it's learning when to peak in the week and when to peak in the show as well, and saving something for that, putting your point shoes on after having worn heels for an hour, to then put your point shoes on and do that big ballet at 10 o'clock at night on Saturday night after you've already done it 7 times, was hard actually. And it was learning how to look after your body. You know, you feel okay on a Monday and you can go to class and you're like, yeah, sure, I'm going to do Grand Allegro. And then by Wednesday matinee, you're already done. Like, your legs are done. And my warm-up on a Monday was very different to my warm-up on a Saturday. Warm-up on a Saturday is very much a bit of Pilates and getting a bit sweaty. But on a Monday, I quite happily do up to jumps in class. But it was very much a steep learning curve of how to get my body ready each different day of the week.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's really interesting, and you're right. It's actually what we do in here in Berlin. We do 8 shows, or sometimes even 6 if it's low season, a week, and it's just such a different. I don't know, it makes the shows very different, but the whole way that I was trained sort of, it changes. Yeah, like the ballet is not about like, oh, I actually want to see if I can do 5 turns today. It's like, actually, just get everything fired up and then see what you can give. Don't kill yourself. You have to be so careful.
Because during lockdown, I was doing, I did a couple of Insta lives.
Yes, I saw those.
One with Chris Wilden. And he said, what I really liked about you, Leanne, is you were really consistent. Mm. And I was like, oh, that sounds so boring. you know, if someone's consistent, such a boring, like you're not like exciting, you're not, yeah. You know, unpredictable, because sometimes unpredictable can be quite exciting to
yes,
watch.
Yeah.
But consistent. I was like, that's so boring. He went, no, he said, because I knew every time I came and watched that show, you were gonna, every night, yeah. You were gonna be gonna get it right. Mm. He said, you were always, always consistent. I was like, okay, I'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah,
that's very boring.
No, I mean, that is, you know, consistency, especially with, as a principal, you know, principals wouldn't do as many shows as you did, at, you know, in Swan Lake, but to have it every day must have been grueling. Your time at the Royal Ballet, kind of, sorry, want to keep like diving backwards.
Would you
have been happy to have, I know we kind of said that you had that little hunger and there was that some seed of like, oh, maybe if it works out, I'll be able to be in the musical after. By the time this all came about, because it did, it sounded like it was quite a surprise, but would you, if it had never have happened, would you have gone out and seeking it yourself? Would you think you were quite happy? Do you think having done 12 years, you would actually felt like you'd done enough?
Ooh, that's hard. I don't think I would have left the Royal Ballet to have done anything else.
Okay.
I was really, really happy there. Mm. And I was getting some lovely things to do as well those last couple of years. But I think maybe if I'd seen there was an open audition for Cats or something, I might have just lined up outside a pineapple with everyone else and given it a go. But I don't think I would have left to do anything else.
Yeah.
I was really lucky that Kevin O'Hare had pretty much only just taken over as director when this first came about. And he likes dancers to go off and try new things. Mm. He encourages it, because of course he wants his dancers to stay at home. But, you know, that to have let Frankie Hayward and Stephen McRae go and do Cats, and he's letting Matthew Ball to go off and do Swan Lake. You know, he looks at it as, well, they'll come back a richer dancer because of it. And I think I'm lucky that he happened to be the director at the time that this project came along. I always enjoyed working. I worked a lot in my younger years in the company with Will Tuckett, and he's done quite a lot of musicals and things. And he actually asked if I could be in his version of Pinocchio, which was going on in the Limbury back. This was my second year in the company, second or third. And at the time, they were like, she's too young. We can't let her go and do anything else. And we need her for Nutcracker. Yeah. We need our snowflakes. So I think maybe if an opportunity had come along with him, and do something. But I don't think I would have necessarily gone out to find it.
Mm. No, yeah. And it's an interesting, because you were so successful, it might have felt like there was further to drop or further to fall if it wasn't what you wanted. But actually, you know, if you never were as successful as you were, you might have been a little bit more, I'll give it a go. But yeah, you kind of had a lot riding on the fact that you were not throwing away, but stepping away from something, like you said before, that so many people would have dreamt for. But I mean, for an opportunity like it was, and the success it had, it was 100% worth it.
Yeah, and they were very supportive as well. Like, they couldn't have been more supportive of me. Like, Kevin was there opening night.
Wow.
Yeah, he came a couple of times, actually. He's a big musical theatre fan.
How lovely. Yeah, that's so nice.
Yeah.
And it's a real testament to you, like you said, the versatility that you had and being able to to step into something new, you know, not, you know, at an older age, like older age for ballet, an older age. Yeah. Because it is, it's so scary, and you're right, time moves so fast in the dance world, and it is so hard. So it isn't a, it was an incredibly brave move. And did you ever have cold feet? Was there ever a moments of regret in, you know, when you were out in New York, or even maybe back in London, that you just like, oh, should I have just, you know, done Snowflakes one more year?
Yeah, I think there were moments. It was when they, when I saw ballets that I loved coming back into the rep and just thinking, oh, I'm never going to do that again. And there were moments where I'd like flick through old photographs and be like, oh, nice. But, and then I'd remember how lucky I was to be doing what I was doing. So yeah, I there definitely were, there were moments. And also that was my family. Like, you know, I'd been to school with a lot of those people. We'd done everything together. We traveled the world together on tours and things. And so I think more, I really missed the dressing room. Yeah. Like, all the girls in the dressing room, because suddenly I was in a room by myself as well. And, you know, getting ready for a show, for me, the atmosphere of everyone buzzing around, and then suddenly I was in this room on my own. And I found that really difficult because I like a buzzy atmosphere before a show. And so I had to like put a podcast on or have music or have, I'd keep my door wide open so anyone could come in at any time, because I just couldn't stand the silence. And I was like, my goodness, the pressure. Can you imagine like going on to do Swan Lake and just having this silence and nobody's in the room with you. So I really missed that actually. I used to spend a lot of my time in the ensemble girls dressing room. I missed that camaraderie of it all.
It's things you wouldn't think of, and that actually is those like really intricate, especially as the dancer, you know, it's so lovely what we do on the stage, but as the dancer, the experiences that I find most people, once, you know, in hindsight, they remember are those really intimate ones, like the dressing room, and you can't really get them back as well, which makes it so bittersweet.
Yeah,
it's amazing. And obviously now it's kind of like a new world for us all, especially as performers. What are you doing at the moment? How are you kind of, what are your horizons like? What are you looking forward to coming out in the world, and how do you think coming out of this lockdown, you know, the dance world, the arts, will change for everyone?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it, because your hope is kind of slashed all the time. You think, we're all going to be okay. And then Boris comes on the news and you're like, no, it's not. Every day it's like, is it nearly there? Isn't it? Yeah. I mean, the good news is in London, you know, we've got the Bridge Theatre open. Sleepless in Seattle seems to be going well. The Mousetrap is opening next month. There are theatres opening. Yeah. Two smaller audiences, of course, but they are opening. The Royal Ballet is doing their first performance on the 9th of October, which is really exciting. So, yeah, it's going to take its time. And I think it will be, it's going to be a long time till it's back to how it used to be with, you know, one of the most thrilling things is to look out at a full theatre, and that's not going to happen for a long time. There's much it's going to be lovely for people to get back on stage, it's not going to feel the same, it's not going to sound the same, it's not going to, that's not going to be for a while, but the fact that the theatres are open is a great thing. And, you know, things are coming up. There's auditions happening. I had to do a self-tape for something last week. So things, you know, things are starting. But, yeah, I don't, who knows what's going to happen and when. But at the moment I'm teaching at Lane Theatre Arts. I'm teaching ballet there. And it's just lovely to teach in a musical theatre college, actually. And obviously, with the COVID situation, there are lots smaller classes. There's only 8 per class at the moment. And that's quite, they're normally like 30, 35 a class. So they might only get to do an exercise in the center like once each. Whereas to have an hour and a half ballet class, only 8 of them, they're not used to that yet. Yeah. So they're loving it. They say it's like having a private lesson every day. But I take time to kind of, sit with them a bit after we've done a bar and when they're stretching. And I had a discussion with them yesterday, actually, and was just saying, can any of you name a choreographer that's done both ballets and musical theatre? And actually they'd studied Christopher Wilde in the year before, so they knew Chris. But can you think of anyone like way, way back when? And one girl was like Agnes DeMille, and I was like, absolutely, of course, like Oklahoma, Carousel, all those amazing old ballets. I said, but you have to think about, you know, Jerome Robbins helped set up the New York City Ballet with Balanchine. And he's probably a lot more famous in the musical theatre world, but if it wasn't for him, the New York City Ballet would not exist. And then I feel like he almost egged on Balanchine, and Balanchine was like, well, if Jerome can do it, I can do it too. And then, of course, Balanchine crossed that path as well between ballet and Broadway with On Your Toes, Slaughter on 10th Avenue. So I just like try and educate them a bit about this kind of cross-section between ballet and musical theatre and how important ballet is. Even if they're not going to be stood on stage in pink tights, tiara and a tutu, ballet is really useful, and to have that as their background and something to fall back on and work on that technique all the time is going to be really, really useful tool to have in their bag for the future.
Yeah, and I think definitely as being in from a ballet establishment myself, though I didn't really try that hard in jazz, I'll own up to it now. I didn't, again, it's that tunnel vision. I didn't want to acknowledge that, like, maybe I couldn't be a ballet dancer and I had to learn these skills. And obviously coming out of it, you know, I did have to learn them. And I was like, oh God, like, should I have done this? I should have tried harder. And there is that stigma. So I think it's so great that you're an example, and like not other young ballet dancers, but like, you know, musical theatre students can see you and go, you know, it is important to do both, you know, from both angles. And you must be a great teacher, I think, you know, that insight of appreciating ballet but knowing what ballet can do for you and translating it must be, give you that such an insight. It must be really, really great to have you as a teacher.
I'm really enjoying it, actually. And like I say, this time in lockdown has made us all think. Also, it's a weird thing with a dancer, because if you're not dancing, are you a dancer? and we all kind of question our identity. Like, if you're not performing, are you a performer? Like, what am I right now? If I'm not employed as a dancer, can I call myself a dancer? So I was really thinking hard about what, you know, and you can't dance forever. As much as we all would love to, it will come to a point where it starts to wind down a bit. And so, you know, I had been teaching a bit, and I'm enrolled in the Royal, but I'm going back to the Royal Ballet School, and I'm doing the teaching diploma.
Okay.
Yeah. So I actually start that tomorrow.
Wow, back to school.
So I'm going back to the Royal Ballet School to learn to be a teacher. And it's weird, because I don't necessarily want to teach at White Lodge as such, though that would be wonderful. But I really do feel like I could be a lot of help to these kids that musical theatre side of it, you know, fingers crossed Phantom will open again here. And, you know, all those that, or even, you know, West Side Story, Carousel, all these amazing old musicals that need a good ballet technique behind them. So I would really love to work in a musical theatre college.
Exactly. Yeah, that sounds just, you're right. It does, it feeds so much. It's like bread and butter. You really do need that emphasis on classical training, because it just opens so many doors. Going back to, you know, now you're teaching and stuff, would there be anything that you would tell your younger self, you know, that kind of, if you had, not with foresight, I guess, but just that you can prepare her for, or just encourage her in a certain direction that you, like, didn't have at the time?
There's so much. I would, because there's things that I'm still really hung up on, about my body, about my limitations. And I'd say to her, don't concentrate on your limitations, concentrate on what you can do, not on what you can't, or what you think you can't. I'd say, just, of course, still, you can't ignore them. They're always going to be there, but to try and look at also at what is special about you, and not forget that, because I think I got so hung up on the fact that my body wasn't right. It's still in my head, your body is not right for ballet. And every time I put on a pair of pointe shoes, or I do a tendu, or I look at myself in the mirror, I'm like, your body is not right for ballet. And now, even as a dancer, I'm not a ballet dancer anymore, but in my head, your body is not right for ballet. And I just wish I could get that out of my head. And I just think now, hopefully if I do become a teacher, is to really, really concentrate on the vocabulary I use for young dancers, and to so that that doesn't become a thing for them. I don't want any other dancer to have this mindset that I have.
Yeah.
It's not productive. It will limit you because you're putting yourself in a box. Mm. You know, we get put in a box by other people. Don't put yourself in a box. That's even worse. So I tell myself to not concentrate on the things I can't, but on the things that I can.
And that's like, I just appreciate your honesty so much. It's so refreshing to not feel alone, because it is, everyone's got that, those couple of words, everyone has that little line that is echoes in their head. And you're right, it can be so limiting, and at times, you know, tragic. It can really, like, you know, unwind people. And it's so encouraging to hear from someone like you, who has that influence now and is going forward onto like teaching, that you will be careful of things like that, because I think there is being like a spring at the moment of people actually saying like, oh, hang on, like, this happened to me, I don't think this is actually right. And I think it takes a really long time to unpick that. But I think if we all make that commitment to not make the same mistakes, it's really good. And I think, you're right, because I don't know whether we're so dogmatic and we can be so focused that actually, which can be really great in some ways and then pushes us and we're so focused and determined, whatever. But then in other ways, we take that focus and that determination and it goes inwards and it harms us, which is the nasty bit, I guess.
I think it's been hard actually during, I'm not sure how much press you get to see from England, from the UK over there in Germany, but there's been a lot of press about the British Gymnastics Society and the kind of psychological aspect of that and how they've been treated. And as much as I don't feel like I was ever mistreated, but I do think things could have been dealt with differently. I have nothing but admiration for the Royal Ballet School, and I'm going back. I mean, if I didn't, I wouldn't be going back there tomorrow to learn from them. I hugely respect them and the company, but I do think we can learn from the past, and it's a good thing to have this open conversation about how we feel and how it felt to be told those things. And if it had been said slightly differently, would I still be thinking about this today? Even if I go to Topshop and try on a pair of jeans, I'm like, oh, but your legs aren't ballet. Like, why am I doing that?
No one else sees that. No one else has that, but you do,
It's so ridiculous. But I do think these conversations are really important, and it's definitely good for the dancers of the future and for the teachers of the future to acknowledge this and to make the positive changes.
Amazing. I mean, like, thank you so much. It's such a good message, and I'm so glad you came to talk to me today. It's so lovely. You have so much insight, and I'm so grateful. So thank you so much. And I hope everything from here is just to get better for you. I mean, like,
I hope so too. I hope it does for everyone. My goodness, it can't get any worse, surely.